From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. One of Michigan's hospital systems had been planning for years for a viral epidemic when reports of the new coronavirus started coming.
We quickly realized that the epidemiology reports that were coming out of Wuhan, China, were different. This was spreading faster and more efficiently than other things that we had seen.
Today, Spectrum Health's top strategist talks about plans for extra ICU beds, COVID-19 testing, supplies, and more. Also, Michigan's manufacturers assess the risks of entering the medical supply market.
All of them share concern for the workers. They also worry about their own future. Can they survive for much longer than the 3 weeks indicated by the governor?
Plus, we have a look at the economic stimulus bill just passed by Congress with Representative Fred Upton. All that and more coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later this hour, we'll talk with the head of emergency preparedness for a West Michigan hospital about how you plan for an unprecedented pandemic. But first, leaders of both political parties have reached an agreement in Washington, D.C. on a $2 trillion bill intended to rush aid to businesses, workers, and a healthcare system slammed by the coronavirus pandemic. This is the largest economic rescue measure in American history. At the same time, a coalition of 16 attorneys general is urging President Trump to go much further, using the Defense Production Act to boost the supply of masks, respirators, and more for the fight against COVID-19. With us to discuss these and other pressing concerns is Congressman Fred Upton. His 6th District hugs Lake Michigan. Fred, welcome back to Stateside.
Well, always a pleasure to be with you. It's a crazy, wild and crazy time. We're all trying to make this thing work as best as we can. We knew it had to be bipartisan, and I'm looking forward to getting this package that the Senate has now agreed on to the president's desk without any changes.
So far, the southeast part of Michigan has been hit the hardest with COVID-19. How is everything in southwest Michigan?
So I've been reaching out to our folks quite a bit, late last night and again this morning. We don't have nearly the same number of incidences, and, you know, I was asking those same questions. Why is southeast a lot more than southwest? Obviously, southeast Michigan is much more dense. You've got a couple big universities there. You've got international flights coming in and out with direct flights to Europe as well as to Asia as well. But, you know, over here on the west side, we've got some pretty big companies with overseas operations like Stryker and Whirlpool, huge operations in Italy as well as China. We have a number of cases. Our providers are ready. We've got some identified cases. One of our hospitals is actually retrofitting a number of rooms, taking out the windows, the outside windows, and actually putting in plywood with holes with fans that will be able to ventilate that air out. To get ready for this, but they're all stretched. They're all short of what we call PPE, personal protection equipment. We're working with the governor. We're working with the vice president's office. We're working with suppliers. We've got a number of industries that want to actually make these masks and ventilators, a whole number of different things, and we're trying to make this and to connect the dots and make it work. But everyone's impacted. Southwest not yet as big as southeast, but you know we're who knows what to expect in the next day or two.
Right. Let's talk for a moment about the economic stimulus package. We hear it includes $1,200 checks for many Americans, creates a $367 billion loan program for small businesses, and establishes a lending fund to the tune of $500 billion that could be tapped by industries as well as by cities and states. Does that sound about right to you?
That's what's been outlined for us in a conference call that we had yesterday. And it appears as though our lenders, our banks, are going to be the ones at the front of the line that's actually maneuvering and being able to shuffle the paper right and get the money directly in the hands of the people that need that lending to try and stay open. So, but you're right. And, of course, the big question that I get everywhere, you know, as people hail me from across the street as we all keep our distance, about these checks, the Treasury tells us that they're going to be able to cut these checks literally in the next 2 to 3 weeks, getting cash in people's hands. So that's an important element of this package, and one that, again, the Senate hopefully passes Wednesday afternoon so that the Senate can, so that the House can either take it up later tonight or tomorrow.
We spoke with someone from the Michigan Retailers Association who said that her members appreciate economic stimulus packages but feel very, very wary about taking on debt in the form of business loans right now. They would like to see items like rent relief, maybe some help with utility bills. What are the odds of something like that happening?
Well, I think that it can. And again, we're all going to be exploring these details. It's my understanding that perhaps a good chunk of the loans can be little interest or no interest at all that can actually turn into a grant later on if that employer retains their employees. We also have another important provision. As you know, we've talked about this before. I'm a member of the Problem Solvers Caucus. This is a bipartisan group of 50 members, and we have four from Michigan, parts of that, Slotkin, Dingell, myself, and Mitchell. We had a conference call earlier this morning. We worked very hard the last week or so to include really loan forbearance or forbearance on the lenders as it relates to their loans that they have to small and large businesses. And one of the things that we were able to do is we're getting the regulators off the backs of the lenders for the next 60 to 90 days so that that won't happen, because we know that to recover, we're going to have these businesses open up again and to provide a workplace for their workers so that they can get a paycheck and continue to contribute to the economy. So that's a very important part of this proposal that the Senate has begun to move on Wednesday and the House to concur on Thursday.
Fred, do you think that more needs to be done to get the country through this right now? The president has been betting that the huge need for medical supplies and protective gear can be met, but he has to this point declined to try to nationalize factories or you know, otherwise try to move the production process along. Would you support the president taking greater action on trying to get medical supplies where they need to be?
We are all working on that. We know that there's a shortage of medical supplies. There was bipartisan legislation introduced that I'm a part of as a Republican earlier this week to help direct the president to see the production of some of these materials that are in really short supply, whether they be masks or swabs. We talked to the governor last night. There's a real shortage of swabs for testing, a whole number of different things. I don't necessarily want to nationalize these businesses. I'm not calling for that. But, in fact, we need, and a good thing is that we've had a number of companies here in Southwest Michigan that are actually looking to change their production to actually produce some of these things. I heard from a business in Grand Rapids, they think they can do masks. We've got a company that we think can do ventilators. Of course, we saw the Ford and GM's announcement earlier in the week as well. So it has to be all hands on deck. We have to be able to deal with this and save not only the lives of our health folks, those on the front line, but the patients that are coming in as well. So I'm hoping that there are more tools in the toolbox that we can utilize to be able to get this equipment. But is this, I think your other question is this the last step that we're going to do? Probably not. I think we're going to wait and see how the country responds to this package that's now moving through the Congress, knowing that there well could be yet another version to come in and help in the next couple weeks.
The president said he would love to have the American economy and American businesses reopened by Easter. Do you think that's the right thing to do?
Well, we'd all love for that to happen, but in all likelihood, it's not. I think you have to, we just have to wait and analyze where things are. The number of counts of those testing positive seems to be doubling every day or two. The number of deaths that are rising as well. We've got real hot spots in certain places around the country, and Michigan is beginning to near one of those hot spots as well. 400 case, new cases yesterday. So as much as we'd like that to happen, I think that we'll see what the evidence says, and it's got to be based on that.
Anything else you'd like for folks to have on their minds right now?
Well, I just want you to know, I mean, we're all working, you know, we're all working out of our houses. I just want to say to our Michigan listeners, our delegation has had a number, not a day goes by that I'm not talking to 8, 10, 12 of my colleagues on both sides of the aisle, trying to work with the governor. I supported what she did in terms of her executive order earlier this week. We've got to get through this. We have to flatten the curve. We have to lower the personal contact that individuals have to break this cycle and hopefully emerge with focus then on finding a cure, finding a vaccine, the right therapeutics. We've got to have the resources to do that, and we have to have the resources to open up business again. And that's going to take a little time, but I can just assure your listeners that all of us are working to try and end this thing that really is more than a nightmare, that's for sure.
Fred Upton, Republican of St. Joseph. Fred, good talking to you. Stay safe.
Yep.
New numbers are coming out every day about the number of coronavirus deaths in Michigan. We're also starting to hear about some of the people who've lost their lives. A 38-year-old police dispatcher, a 47-year-old mother of four, and Marlo Stoudemire, a 43-year-old entrepreneur and Detroit community leader. He died this week from complications related to the coronavirus. Let's listen to his voice. Here's Stoudemire on Detroit public television program American Black Journal. He's talking with host Stephen Henderson about a project he started called Roster Detroit.
Well, it all started with three things. So I was very frustrated with a Black History Month that felt kind of muted and kind of old. The images that I was seeing and hearing about Black men, particularly on Facebook and social media, and then this notion of Detroit not having talent. And every time we have a conversation about what talent is or what it looks like, it was the traditional white male millennial or the person riding in on their horse to save Detroit. And I said, that's not the Detroit I know. And so instead of me complaining, I said, you know what? There's people within my network, brothers who I can lift up. And I started doing a story, two stories every day. Mm-hmm. And just to tell people, like, these are the guys that I know.
Stoudemire's friends and colleagues have been sharing their grief very publicly. Our sympathies go out to everyone who had him in their life. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Across the state, millions of Michiganders are staying home after the governor issued a shelter-in-place order. But what if you don't have a home? The order makes no mention of people who are experiencing life on the streets right now. Interlochen Public Radio's Max Johnston went out to see how they're faring during the coronavirus pandemic.
Members of the Street Outreach Team for Goodwill of Northern Michigan are walking through some woods in Traverse City. These serve as de facto camps for some of the area's homeless and unsheltered population. Eventually, we come across a man named Jay. Jay slept in the woods last night, but he's well-equipped, wearing a thick jacket, long johns, and snow pants.
The only thing that got cold last night was my feet.
Jay is currently homeless, but he did apply for an apartment through the city's housing voucher program. But he says he can't even think about all that right now.
Considering that, you know, I have no place to live at the moment, and considering, you know, the food and water situation is going to be on my mind every day. So that's just, there's just too much going on right now for that.
Jay says he'll scope out another spot to camp in these woods until the shelter-in-place order is lifted. The team gives him some hand warmers and some phone numbers to call if he's feeling sick. Over the course of the day, Ryan Hannon, who leads the outreach team, gave supplies to about a half dozen more people camping in the woods.
All right, guys, keep up the good work. Stay warm and healthy. Reach out if you need, okay?
All right.
Hannon says he normally checks in with the unsheltered like this across the five-county area every few days. But since this pandemic started, Goodwill has cut down on those trips. They're trying to avoid crowds where they could catch or spread the coronavirus. For now, they're focusing on keeping people healthy. Goodwill works with doctors that can consult with people experiencing homelessness over the phone.
They can talk to the doctor right there in the video if we need, and then get further instructions on what to do next if someone feels or the doctor feels they may have COVID-19, we're able to instruct on what to do next.
The governor's shelter-in-place order mandates that everyone stay home. It has exceptions for essential services like Goodwill, but doesn't mention anything about people experiencing homelessness that have no shelter. Ryan Hannon has worked in homeless outreach for over a decade, but even he doesn't know what this order means for the unsheltered.
I don't know moving forward if the community is going to force people if they're out there. Certainly, if they're going to force people, there's going to have to be somewhere to go.
No one's been forced to go anywhere yet, but one place they can go is the Safe Harbor Homeless Shelter in Traverse City. Mike McDonald is Safe Harbor's chairperson. He says they've taken precautions to avoid spreading COVID-19. They've gotten hotel rooms for young people or vulnerable guests with health problems. They've given out tents so others can camp outside, and converted a chapel and dining area into spots for people to sleep. All that has lowered Safe Harbor's occupancy from their normal range of around 70 people down to just 50 staying in the shelter itself. McDonald admits this isn't ideal, but
the alternative would be to close the shelter and throw everybody out the elements, and that's very dangerous as well. So, you know, and we're not going to do that.
McDonald says, like many community organizations these days, they're also understaffed. Safe Harbor relies on senior citizens for help, but many have been sent home due to the high risk COVID-19 poses to older adults. So far, the day-to-day life of the unsheltered or people without homes hasn't changed. Grand Traverse County Sheriff Tom Bensley says people experiencing homelessness that normally hang out at places like libraries or laundromats obviously don't have that option anymore. But he says for now, his officers won't be writing tickets to anyone that's out, and they'll direct them to places like Goodwill or Safe Harbor. But Bensley says they're getting updated rules on the order from the state nearly every hour, and they may change.
It's kind of like drinking from a fire hose, and we don't have time to digest one before we get the next.
Bensley says all they can do is wait for more guidance from the state on how to enforce the shelter-in-place order. As of Tuesday afternoon, the governor's office has not responded to a question about how the order affects people experiencing homelessness. In Traverse City, I'm Max Johnston.
Michigan is among the many states desperately trying to get hold of important medical equipment and devices to save lives and slow the global pandemic. Ventilators, surgical masks, gloves, gowns, you name it, it's pretty much needed right now. Makers are working on the problem. From everyday Michiganders with consumer-grade 3D printers or a sewing machine to some of the state's biggest industries. As we've heard on the show, some things are easier to make than others. But Ford CEO Jim Hackett told NPR on Tuesday he believes his company can retrofit some of its plants to make ventilators within a matter of months.
By mid-May, we should start being halfway up the curve of scaling this. By June, you'd be producing at a rate that would be able to make $900,000 a year.
Governor Whitmer has made a very specific request of the state's industrial sector. With us now is John Walsh, president and CEO of the Michigan Manufacturers Association. John, good to have you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Could you give us an overview of what Governor Whitmer requested of the manufacturing community and what happened after she made that statement?
Sure. Last week, we and other associations, as well as the manufacturing community in general, learned from the administration that there were going to be shortages in a number of areas. Hand sanitizer, certainly at the retail level. I'll talk a little bit about how some people are addressing that. But also with regard to ventilators, respirators, hospital beds, patient gowns, every aspect of what you might need in the hospital, there's going to be a press on our hospital system. And they're looking for a variety of items.
They're coordinating most of that, the administration, through the State Emergency Operations Center, which is part Homeland Security and part Michigan State Police, a collaborative venture. And we put a call out to our members in a blast to our 1,600 members, and nearly 300 members have responded, sometimes with great specifics, other times just saying, we want to help, we're just not sure. We build something out of plastic, perhaps we can make a shield, for instance.
A face shield, yeah.
Yes, correct. So it's been a great response.
Were any of the offers particularly surprising?
I wouldn't say any particular offer was surprising, but to learn rapidly how quickly a manufacturer can turn around. Some couldn't tool fast enough, but others said, look, by the end of the week, if you give me the specifications, I can be producing 100 patient gowns. That's a specific offer from Roush in Livonia, Michigan. It's just remarkable that some of our manufacturers are able to do things so quickly. You know, they're making parts for the automotive industry or heavy construction, and yet they're able to use their laser printers or they're able to tool quickly to produce hospital gowns, in this case by Roush. They're still trying to get their way into the queue, but the fact that they were able to quote a product in a time frame was remarkable.
I imagine it's not terribly hard to communicate to a manufacturing company what's going to be needed out of a hospital gown. But is it difficult to get specs on some things like maybe surgical quality breathing masks or mm-hmm. things that might be a little more proprietary within certain industries?
There are certainly proprietary issues to be addressed. And I think Ford, you know, at the larger end of our scale of members, what they did is they reached out to fellow companies that were participating in production already and worked out directly the ability to adjust those needs. Some of the smaller manufacturers are still trying to work that out with those that have proprietary rights. And I understand that. What I can tell you, though, is those conversations are moving along rapidly.
At the time we're having this conversation, do you know if any of the new producers of medical equipment and supplies have started production yet?
I don't, and I'm sorry that I can't tell you that. What we're doing is we're filtering through our membership lists. And for those that we think, based on our communication with the state, can do something quickly, we're turning that right over to the SEOC, and they're dealing directly with the manufacturers. You know, we wanted to remove a middleman, but I will stay in touch with you as time goes on, because I think things will start to flip fairly quickly.
Can you give us a sense of how many companies in Michigan are producing medical equipment and supplies already? What the bench looked like before all this began?
Well, it's a heavy bench, and that's a difficult question to quantify simply for this reason. You have an end producer or assembler that actually delivers the goods to the hospital industry, and that's going to be in the tens to 100. But then the supply chain is so much more involved. Now you could get to hundreds upon hundreds. For instance, a face mask, a paper face mask, includes some amount of steel. So that goes all the way back to a steel foundry and every step in between taking raw steel and moving it to a little thin wire that's used in a mask. So we can't fully quantify the supply chain, but thankfully the governor's executive order will allow the entire supply chain to be involved in the process.
John, is anybody coordinating at this point where the new manufacturing orders will go?
So our touch point has been the SEOC, the State Emergency Operations Center. The Michigan Health and Hospital Association has stepped forward to help sometimes put manufacturers directly in touch with the hospitals themselves. But for the most part, we've been working with the SEOC.
Right now, a number of states have been trying to buy up medical supplies, as many as they can, as many as they think they're going to need. Is there any guarantee that supplies made in Michigan will be sold in Michigan?
Well, our goal is to do that, just that. Of course, we want to be supportive of any individual that is ill. But our primary objective here is to make use of our existing manufacturing base and help Michigan first. And that's why our priority has been to work with the SEOC.
Right. And can you explain anything about how orders are being routed through there, and then they communicate to the companies where to send things?
That's correct. So we're helping identify
opportunities, but the actual matchmaking, the manufacturing, and the delivery will be directed by the SCOC.
It feels like the whole process of trying to supply emergency medical needs has gotten really complicated really fast. Just yesterday, the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, made a comment that masks we used to pay 85 cents for, quoting here, we're now paying $7 for. I don't think he was talking about new companies coming online and trying to gouge people. I think he was talking about some existing supply and demand in the market. But it just seems to underline what happens if there's no one making executive decisions about who's going to make what, where the products will go, and are things serious enough that, you know, maybe the federal government needs to step in and start answering those questions in a much more forceful way. Do you think that any of these efforts are going to change as we continue to see the spread of the virus? Would you expect to see any Michigan companies maybe drafted into a national effort?
Absolutely. You know, some of our largest manufacturers, and not just the big three, but the supply chain, they do have the capacity, they have the interest. So as they address the issues of where is the need, their tooling, the proprietary information, all of these things are happening simultaneously. But I fully expect that some of them will be providing products across the country.
Do you know anything about how prices are being set for scarce resources right now?
I don't. Of course, we have a capitalistic market, and so that there is always a supply and demand. On the other hand, you know, there can be as many stories of gouging as there are companies that stand up and say, we're going to make this immediately available, and we're not going to worry. We'll figure out the pay later. There's no central authority that I'm aware of, so I have to qualify it with that. The SCOC is negotiating directly with the manufacturers on quantity, transportation, and price, but there's no central authority on it.
Are there any particular kinds of goods that Michigan's manufacturers are particularly well positioned to provide?
Certainly plastics. You know, we have a very, very healthy chemical-based supply base here in Michigan that leads to plastics of all type, and many of our manufacturers are used to working with plastics. So that can go into almost any number of personal protection items for the healthcare industry. To go back to Ford, I can only cite what I've read and heard on other news outlets, but they have a small fan that they use in one of their vehicles that may well be helpful with either respirators or ventilators. I can't recall which product. But there's a variety of things out there. One of the biggest things that we heard from our smaller manufacturers, and large for that matter, but really smaller, is they have an enormous sewing capacity, to use their words, gowns, to finish a mask, you know, to help with bedding. That has been one of the most routine offers of help.
John, I can't let you go without asking how the manufacturers that you talk to every day are doing right now.
Well, it's there's a lot of concern. We have 85% of our members are in the smaller category, family owned, and of course we represent the larger ones as well. All of them share concern for the workers, for those that had to close that are not working. They also worry a bit about their own future. Can they survive a shutdown for much longer than the 3 weeks indicated by the governor? There also is an underlying understanding of the seriousness of the situation, the health care for our society, for their workers, for their families. So it's a very mixed and very emotional response, I think, from all of us. But you asked on manufacturers, they're sharing it at their family level at home, but they're also sharing it at the level of their work family, so to speak.
Is it too much to hope that the retooling of this select number of manufacturers might be able to keep some of the folks whose jobs are idle right now employed?
Oh, absolutely. You know, that's absolutely clear. There will be some folks that will be able to be going to work and keeping healthy themselves and keeping their business healthy and provide these products. I think just from a personal observation, it is remarkable the things that I'm seeing that people and companies are doing in the face of this this very serious threat. We often can become mired in the worst of it, but yet we stand. You know, our neighbors, our leaders, our business community, we stand up to things here, and I find that rewarding.
John, thank you very much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Glad to be on.
John Walsh is the president and CEO of the Michigan Manufacturers Association. He joined us via Skype. Just a reminder, as you're picking out your Netflix queue for tonight, we are still running our March Movie Madness Tournament on Instagram right now. We've picked out 16 films set in Michigan, filmed in Michigan, or just plain about Michigan. We want you to help us narrow it down to the most quintessentially Michigan movie of them all. Which film is it that best captures what it means to be in the Mitten State? You can find the list of our Sweet 16 contenders at michiganradio.org. And head over to Michigan Radio's Instagram stories to vote for the most quintessentially Michigan movie. Coming up, Spectrum Health Hospital System has been developing a pandemic response plan for more than a decade. Now they're putting that plan to the test.
And while we've had instances of scares like Ebola, SARS, MERS-CoV, we've never actually enacted our plans to this level except in exercising.
How to prepare for the unprecedented. That's next on Stateside. Stick around. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. More than a decade ago, a West Michigan hospital system decided to take a federal grant for epidemic preparedness. At the time, it might have sounded like a random decision. But today, Spectrum Health, based in Grand Rapids, considers itself as prepared as any organization of its size can be for the surge in coronavirus cases. Mark Van Dyke is manager of business assurance for Spectrum Health. What his title means is that he's in charge of making sure that staff knows what to do in an emergency, but also ensuring that supplies and business operations and other things keep flowing as smoothly as possible, even during a pandemic. Mark Van Dyke, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Your background is in emergency preparedness. Have you ever been through anything remotely like this before?
Not necessarily in real life, but definitely in planning. We actually started this type of planning over 10 years ago when we received a federal grant from the CDC on pandemic planning. When we received that grant, we really took initiative to say, yes, if this were to happen in our area, in our country, we want to be ready. We want to be able to serve our customers and our patients. And so we have been exercising this plan, talking about this plan for a long time. And while we've had instances of scares like Ebola, SARS, MERS-CoV, we've never actually enacted our plans to this level except in exercising.
Can you tell us a little bit about the moment at which you realized that this was going to be something of pandemic proportions, not just in Wuhan, not just in Italy, but here in Michigan as well?
I would say that while we had gone through our early steps in December and in January, those are very typical steps for us to take during even a normal influenza season. When we brought up our pandemic task force in early January, we quickly realized that the epidemiology reports that were coming out of Wuhan, China, were different. This was spreading faster and more efficiently than other things that we had seen. When it had come into the United States in the Seattle area, we realized that we had to accelerate our planning. And so working through that, I would say probably in early February, we realized that this was not going to stop. This was not a typical situation that we had practiced for in the past, that we needed to open our command center and be prepared to respond to a surge of patients in our area.
We have felt as though we are giving the word unprecedented a pretty serious workout in describing the current conditions right now. Talk to us about how you prepare a hospital system for something like that.
There are several stages in pandemic planning. First, ensuring that our staff are available during the surge of patients that's coming and making sure that we're taking every precaution that we can to make sure that they are safe and healthy. The next thing is to ensure that we have beds and staff available is by eliminating non-essential services like elective procedures, well child visits, other services that are not for emergency care. What we're doing is we're reducing the number of people in our facility. We're reducing the number of beds that are taken by an elective procedure. And so we're freeing up that staff and that space to take on a patient that may be impacted during the pandemic. And so that when the surge happens, we are actually just refilling our hospital rather than having to surge outside of our hospital.
Was there anything that your team was able to do in terms of supplies once it became evident that things like ventilators and masks and gloves and cleaning supplies were going to be in very, very high demand?
So, you know, we're all very well aware that there are shortages across the country in ventilators and N95 masks. We have taken every precaution possible to ensure that our staff are using the proper protective equipment in the right moment and training our staff and retraining our staff and assuring that they are using the equipment properly. And we're working along with our state agencies and our national agencies trying to actively resolve those issues. We are following the CDC guidelines for acceptable alternatives, and we so continually prioritize based on the treatment and care needs of our patients.
Can you give us an example of what it means to use equipment and supplies at the, I think the phrase you used was at the appropriate time?
Sure. You know, when there is an abundance of supply, we allow ourselves to take additional precautions in situations. And in a pandemic where we have a scarce resource, we want to continue to educate our staff about what is the proper protective equipment for in the moment. So if a patient with that is not associated with COVID-19 or not associated with a respiratory illness, if they don't have the indication that they need additional protection, we work with our infection prevention team as well as our personal protective equipment experts, and we talk to our staff about what is the appropriate level of personal protective equipment for this patient versus the patient that they'll see next. And this resolves a lot of anxiety in our staff and makes sure that they feel safe going into every patient room and make sure that they're safe and make sure that we have the resources long term so that we are conserving and properly using our PPE during this time.
What are you feeling right now as you look to the east side of the state? You know, the governor stated publicly that Beaumont Hospital is pretty close to capacity right now. Does that weigh on your mind at all?
Yeah, you know, we saw it hit Seattle. We saw it hit some of the larger cities on the West Coast, then over to New York, and now on the east side of Michigan. It's just getting closer, and our mindset of readiness continues to increase. And so we are ready for the surge when it hits the west side of the state. We're ready to increase our numbers of patients. And while it just continues to get closer and seems inevitable to hit the west side of Michigan, we have been in a readiness stance for several weeks now and feeling very prepared.
Did I hear you mention that you're working with some equipment suppliers who are stepping in to make things either at a higher capacity or make things that they don't usually make to try to help out with demand?
Yeah, so we've had a tremendous amount of outpouring from a lot of different partners, and I don't want to leave anyone out, but one that I'll mention just off the top of my head is Amway, who started producing hand sanitizer for us and offered it as a donation to our hospital. So we recently established an alternate care site, which is the official term for moving patients outside your traditional hospital, and working with Grand Valley State University, who has offered up their Cook DeVos Science Building. And this is not just something they just did. This has been a long-term relationship that we have practiced where we can establish up to a 250-bed hospital within their health science building, which is right across from our medical center. And just the outpouring of support from the Grand Valley community and all of the companies that have to come together to ensure that we have the right equipment in a facility like that to increase our capabilities in downtown Grand Rapids is just, it's mind-blowing, really.
Mark, can you tell us a little bit about the specialized biocontainment unit within Spectrum? It was something that was developed during the 2014 Ebola outbreak. How useful is that in a situation like the one we're facing now with the new coronavirus?
It's not from a perspective of technology and space, because we will quickly outgrow that space. But what is helpful as being the Tier 1 infectious disease unit is that we have process in place to assist our staff with personal protective equipment to keep them safe. One thing that came out of that unit was something that we call the hot zone boss. And I'm not sure that we came up with that. I think we probably borrowed that from a healthcare friend. But what we do is we have a staff member who is specifically trained in how to put on and take off PPE, which can be the most dangerous spot for a healthcare worker. And they watch our staff who are entering and exiting rooms to ensure that the gloves and the masks are taking off properly to limit the exposure to infectious diseases. And that is valuable in a situation like Ebola, where something is highly infectious, and even something now with COVID-19 for, number one, limiting spread, and number two, ensuring that our staff feel comfortable in this situation.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Van Dyke, Manager of Business Assurance for Spectrum Health. What that title means is that he's in charge of the emergency preparedness planning that has become one of the cornerstones of Spectrum's business. Information changes so quickly as COVID-19 has spread. How are you and the staff keeping up on what's going on?
So, yes, it does change quickly. So what we have established is a formal command center that has many different branches. And our command center, like many command centers in healthcare, activate at different levels. And we have gone from a single room in our typical operations command center to multiple rooms spread out across our organization. But one of the goals of our infectious disease team is to continue to monitor the World Health Organization and the CDC websites for any changes related to guidelines on personal protective equipment. Another group that we have is called the data and analytics team that is monitoring what we are seeing and what others are seeing in our area and our region and our country, so that we can have predictive modeling related to what we believe will be coming next.
Can you give me an example of like the kind of trend or information that is important?
So a lot of the data they're trending is equipment and supplies. How much do we have on hand? How much donations are coming in? Our staff ill calls, we are tracking that. We are tracking the number of patients that we're seeing in our virtual screening assessment. We have a virtual screening as well as a telehealth system set up. So all of those trends will lead us into analytical data that will show us what we can expect as we climb this curve.
Can you tell us anything about how many patients Spectrum can test every day and how fast the results are coming back?
So I can tell you that we now have the capability to test in our own lab, and in that lab we can test up to 700 patients a day.
Wow. Does that mean that people can't? I mean, I don't want to start off a rush to the doors of Spectrum, but are you close to being able to test people who, and anyone whose doctor refers them over?
The limitation that we have is the actual viral media that runs the test. So testing capabilities versus the ability to actually run a test on a patient is something that obviously we've heard about in the news, and we're working through that process with our suppliers, and we're trying to figure out different methodologies. But we have a fantastic virtual medicine program called Spectrum Health Now that we can process through people and screen people through, and if it's appropriate, we get them test. Now, we do follow our criteria and who is getting tested, right? And so it's not just anyone who asked to get tested. We have very specific criteria, starting with our critical care patients and our inpatients, to ensure that we're still want to make sure that the people who are in need to be hospitalized are getting the appropriate care for what they have tested positive for.
Mark, stories coming out of Italy, I think, represented a wake-up call for a lot of us who may not have thought that we would see true scarcity of healthcare and medical care during our lifetimes. And we know that a lot of hospitals overseas have struggled with decisions about the best use of scarce equipment and staff time. Can you tell us about how emergency planning addresses those issues?
So, again, I'll reference the CDC document that we wrote in 2008. discussed the scarce resource allocation and how will we deal with that exact situation during a pandemic. And a lot of it has to do with understanding patient by patient what is needed, is it available, and if there's a decision to make. Several weeks ago, we stood up our ethics committee who will review these situations if they come to us. We have re-looked at and made changes where appropriate just due to time and talked about what will this look like if it comes here. So I agree, we've never experienced that level of scarce resources here in our lifetime. And our hope is that we have taken protections in our area and in our state under the governor's orders and by the directive of our CEO well in advance to minimize exposure in our area, that we are flattening that curve and we hopefully will not experience those.
It's obvious that you and your team have done a tremendous amount of thinking about all of this, but is there anything that's still keeping you up at night?
There are two things that are constantly on my mind. The first being that I want our staff to know that we are doing everything for their safety and making decisions for their safety and prioritizing what they are doing to make sure that they stay safe through this thing. And the second thing is that our patients and our community know that we're ready. We're ready to handle this in West Michigan. We have discussed this. We've planned it. We've practiced it. And while, yes, this is going to happen, we're going to manage it the best of our ability. And, you know, we also want to make sure that our community is doing their part. And we have to rely on our community to follow the executive order of the governor and to follow the instructions they've been given to stay home and stay safe. And we need to work together to flatten that curve.
Yeah. Some other hospital administrators have been sounding the alarm that the business side of their operations are going way out of balance. One of the things that you're responsible for is figuring out how systems like payroll will keep going in the course of an epidemic or a pandemic. In other places, elective surgeries, which keep cash flowing, have come to a standstill. Do you have anything in place that might insulate Spectrum from that kind of trouble, or are you very far from that point?
So we have made decisions, and I'm going to give a lot of credit to our CEO and our senior leadership team, that we are making decisions about making sure our staff are safe and our community is safe. And we are doing a fair amount of work, as documented, and how to do this process by the response agencies that are out there, including FEMA, of how to document financial situations during this time. And that was one of the first things that we always do during any type of disaster, is understand the cost related to this. Our stance is that if we don't do the proactive measures that we have taken place, including the cancellation of elective surgeries, the cost that we will incur in the future for not being ready will be far greater and far more debilitating than what we're doing today.
Mark, as someone who's overseeing emergency preparedness literally in the middle of a global pandemic, can you share anything with us about what your life has been like over the past couple of weeks?
A lot. It's been a lot of work and a lot of hours, and even a couple naps in my office. Don't tell my boss. And thankfully, because of the emphasis that we put on preparedness at Spectrum Health, I have a tremendous team that's supporting us, and they pick up where I lack in, and they are an unbelievable team that has been supporting this effort 24/7. And so there's great comfort in the fact that I'm not alone. And while, yes, it's busy, and yes, there's a lot of phone calls even when you do get home, and unfortunately less than ideal meals sometimes, this is part of the response plan that we have planned for and practiced for. And part of me is just extremely proud to be here with this organization at this time.
Mark Van Dyke, thank you so much for everything that you're doing and for taking some time to talk to us.
Thank you.
Mark Van Dyke is Manager of Business Assurance for Spectrum Health in Kent County. That's our show for today. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening.